Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
All right. Hello, everyone. This is a really unfortunate situation that I have to do through a camera, but I have 5 minutes and I would like to talk about a thing that I really think about lately a lot. It's about our lives. And, well, I know that maybe this seems like out of context, but to me it's quite relevant because, well, I ended up I was growing up and my mother used to show me our like family photos and everything. Just there was letters written and pictures and everything. But I realized that after I lost my first hard drive and there was a lot of family pictures and etc. were there, well, they are lost forever. And I just come to understand that our digital lives is actually not as, well, just rugged as our analog life. Nowadays, you don't get to print much. And we are doing is actually keeping them on our, like, flash drives, like our hard drives, or perhaps we don't even store them, we just keep them on our mobile phones and etc., which can be stolen and get lost quite easily. But the thing is not about how we store the data actually, it's about how we are actually keeping it safe. Nowadays, while we are encrypting everything, and by everything, I mean everything. Like the data on the transit is encrypted. That some storage are encrypted, and well, encryption is the only thing actually right now stop people. And there are a lot of people who are after our data, just a profit, perhaps. But sometimes just some really curious friends and curious family members can really after your private information, such as your your conversations, perhaps your pictures, and etc. And since we're trying to balance this, we are, well, currently encrypting everything. Well, at least I do, and I know a lot of people do. But the problem with encryption is just like we are just making the data, which is already quite fragile, more and more fragile. Because, well, there's a key to keep track of, and there's most of the time there's a password that protects the key. And also the encrypted data somewhere, and none of them is actually resilient to any kind of damage. So how do we do that? And since, well, meaningful encryption and protection means that you also keep the key to yourself and don't share it with anybody else, and what happens when you die? Because, well, I know what happens when you die, like 20 years ago, 40 years ago, your family members would have kept your photos and etc., your letters. But today, well, they cannot get into your social media accounts, which, well, you shouldn't have. And they cannot read your emails, because, well, there is a password for it. They cannot, well, perhaps see your pictures and, well, just remember you, because, well, they are encrypted into a drive and the key is who knows where. And to get to the point, actually, we really need encryption. We really need to just self-maintain that encryption, so which means that you own the key, you keep the key, and you're solely responsible for that key. But you need to also plan how you are going to, well, just let that data after you die. So I really recommend everybody to think about it, really, just how we manage that. Well, probably a lot of things going to be go through, because every personal need is quite different than the other. Some people don't want to just be existing anymore, just because, well, if you're encrypting everything and if you lost the key, which is lost with you, then, well, do you get to exist? Because, well, people are just quite easily forgetting things, and just you will be forgotten probably after one or two generations. So that information is important. So the personal identity or just personal existence in your mind is affecting how you're going to leave the stuff behind. So personally, I can share my experience, well, as a suggestion, and you can grow from there. To me, actually, there's a three step. There are things that I'm going to take grave with me. There are things that I, well, just probably reveal to my family and close friends. And there are things that, well, just they don't matter where they are. So I have a GPG key, and I have a symmetrical password that I symmetrically encrypt things. So I have a will that says that how this information is stored, with what key, which key, or how it's encrypted, and where they are staying, and who can actually get access to it, which is, well, also encrypted to to people that I trust, and they are keeping that they don't keep that information. But, well, upon my death, probably they will find the will, and hopefully they will be decrypted and get to information that I really willing to share with them after my death. And what is this to do with the free software? And, well, life goes on, and if you want to exist with the society, you should be depending on something that lives with the society and works for the society. And that is what actually defines free software in that sense. So if you are going to trust something that will be, well, in control of somebody else, if it's going to be vanish, if a company bankrupts, or if the developer just stops developing the software, it doesn't make any sense, right? So encryption software in this context that is free, available to everybody, and, well, just self-maintained, which is GPG is fitting the bill, is actually the best tool to have. It was here like 30 years ago, it is still here, and probably it will stay, well, another century perhaps. So we're encrypting everything, and everything that we hold dear, actually, depending on that encryption. And, well, maintain your keys, be safe, and, well, be safe with free software and a free society. Thank you very much for listening.
Hello, I'm Janneke. This talk is about GNU Mesh and our efforts to create an auditable, full-source bootstrap for our free software systems. MeshCC is a C99 compiler written in a subset of Kyle's scheme and comes with Mesh, the scheme interpreter, to run it. In the 80s, Ken Thompson showed us the growing trust problem that was being introduced in computing. His message has mostly been ignored. We are injecting more and larger binary seeds to build our free software systems. The importance to stop this trend was evident to Bitcoin developer Carl Dong of Chaincode Labs. I warmly recommend the talk he gave at the Breaking Bitcoin conference this summer. Bitcoin has implemented Gitian, a system that uses reproducible builds. Let's say you wrote the first ever GNU CC compiler, and you wrote it in C. It is impossible to compile this C source code into an executable GCC program. Ah, but that's just like making yogurt. Use fresh milk and add some yogurt leftover from yesterday. Using this insight, we can now create our second GCC. We take fresh, security audited milk. We publish the recipe so that others may verify the result. And lo and behold, your second compiler exactly matches ours, as long as you follow our recipe and use the exact same first compiler, then everyone is just as bug-free and secure as our first shared compiler was. Reproducibility is no substitute for bootstrappability. And while bug-free source code remains important, we need something else. Enter GNU Geeks. In Geeks, we implement a reduced binary seed bootstrap. A full GNU Linux system is bootstrapped from only 60 megabytes of trusted binaries. So we are very excited that Agnelnet provided a grant to make that possible. And this is what the graph looks like right now. The only interesting binaries left are a scheme interpreter and a scheme compiler, GNU-mess and GNU-guile. Given that we dislike downloading binaries and trusting them, why not stop doing so altogether? We are creating a full source bootstrap path. Are we doing this only to counter the trusting trust attack? I think that building from source is the proper way to do computing, and the trusting trust attack is only a symptom of confusing a binary substitute with the compilation of source code. I'm very grateful for getting so much help and seeing this crazy project grow. Well, that's all, folks.
Hello, I'm Joey Hess. I just wanted to first say that I'm really so proud of the Free Software Foundation for coming together and converting this conference to a virtual conference and making it into such a success in such amazing short notice. It really speaks to what an amazing organization they are. And now that we're in a virtual conference, I've been feeling really kind of excited by all the possibilities of virtual conferences. It seems to me that we've had our IRC streams and our live videos and a few other things that we have on the side, but now that they're the main attraction, I think that there's the opportunity for innovation that we haven't seen, and I think maybe it's going to make things better in the long run for conferences, for remote attendees, to have this opportunity where everybody's thinking about this kind of thing. As soon as LibrePlanet was announced to be a virtual conference, I decided to do a little hacking spree and try to develop some software to do something hopefully new and unique and innovative in the space of virtual conferences. And what I came up with and put together is this little web interface called the Virtual Hallway Track. And you might have seen me mentioning it in IRC or other places during Library Planet. Some people have been using it so far. I hope that more people will use it. The idea is that it's you see people in a place and you can go into different groups, circles of people who are talking together within themselves. So it's a small group of people speaking in the conference venue, kind of like when you're standing around in the hall and, you know, you're in a group and it gets bigger and then maybe it gets too big and it kind of splits off into two groups. And then maybe you see your friend down the hall and you go to say hi to them and ask them what's been going on. That's the kind of dynamic that my program hopefully lets happen. And I think it has. I think that the conversation I'm seeing in there is more loose and freeform and informal and stuff than what you see on IRC in a way. It's a different venue, you know, it's the medium is the message thing. You get a different effect. You obviously can't fully replicate how amazing it can be to meet people in real life that way, but you start to approach it. And I'm thinking about enhancements to it. Like, for example, maybe when you get into a small group of people, they're all in Jitsi Meet. And when you move to a different group, you suddenly pop into the Jitsi Meet of the other group. So I'm going to try to develop these things. And further, I'm thinking that it might make sense to have a virtual conference about how to make better virtual conferences, which would mostly involve better free software for making virtual conferences. Maybe people will come up with other ideas like this and have a little while to build them and then present them, and then the conferences run with them. You know, it kind of builds itself as it goes. I don't know. If you're interested in that, please get in touch with me. I should be in IRC during this talk, and I'll try to show a couple of screenshots too. And happy hacking. Have a good conference, and I hope to see you all in person next year. Bye.
I want to share my vision for Freeing in the Future. My name is Roberto, and I've been organizing Libre Miami for a few months now. What we do is advocate for and help people with Libre software, and I really don't see why we can't have more local groups like mine all over the United States. It would give us a really great diversity boost with fresh ideas and fresh perspectives that we can test out on a local level to see what works and what doesn't, and advance the state of advocacy. It would also give us access to local communities and local politics where we have feet on the ground to address any threats to freedom on a local level. On top of it all, if any of you were to come to Miami right now, not only could I tell you where the best Nicaraguan food is, help you network, I can also give you a view of the city from a Libre perspective, because I get it. Imagine if you could do that in every major U.S. city. So if there isn't a Libre Planet group in your area right now, which is likely, go ahead and start one. I really encourage you to just get one started because it's very easy, it's a lot of fun, and it really doesn't have to take a lot of time commitment. And more importantly, if you're watching this right now, I can say without a shadow of a doubt that you are the most qualified person for the job. Because you could be the worst at everything. You could be the worst promoter. You could be the worst developer. You could be the worst speaker. But none of that matters because you have the most important thing, which is an unrivaled passion and understanding of the free software issue. So you can lead your community. And I really encourage you to step up and do it. Again, it's really easy. The hardest part is probably just setting up a page on the wiki. And all you have to do is make an account, make a few edits if you need page creation privileges, and then you claim your territory, which can be as big or as little as you want it to be. And you don't have to be over or under anybody if you don't want to. Then you just need a place to meet, and I would recommend the easiest thing is just any kind of shop. Any tea shop or coffee shop or anything like that would be happy to have you. I haven't had one turn me down yet. and you don't have to do any paperwork. If you want to be polite, you can go ahead and ask, but more likely than not, they'd be also just happy to have you show it with people. If you want things to be a little more official, you can do a library. That takes very little paperwork usually, and you know, then it's a little bit more official. And you can just get creative with it. You know, you can find somewhere to meet. Then once you have a place and a time, you can start off with once a month if you want to. Then just make a put that information on the wiki, and then just go ahead and email the two emails that I have posted up to announce your group. And what that's going to do is help you find people in your area that might be interested in joining your group. So right off the bat, you might have membership, and then there you go, you have a group. If you want to take it to the next level, my best tips are to be effective. Don't spin your wheels thinking about that you need all this material or that you need to have all these things prepared, because it's really hard to anticipate the kind of needs that your members and your community are going to have. And kind of relevant to that, get out there and get involved with your local tech scene and your community to see what needs they have so that you know how to, or you can figure out how to address those needs with Libre software. Because what that's going to do is create a lot of value. And once you recognize that value and you recognize your own talents, then you're going to have a great group, because it's not going to be a matter of other people or having to convince other people to come to your group. They're going to want to just come because your group is so fantastic. So, you know, leverage your talents and also leverage any Libre tools that might be out there that could help you with your group. I have some posted there. And, you know, just promote. And if you want some inspiration, you can check out LibreMiami.org. Thanks for hearing me out. Happy hacking. Free the future.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this lightning talk for LibrePlanet 2020. I'm going to talk about MagmaGuide, and I'm Vasilis Ververis. So, what is the MagmaGuide? The MagmaGuide is a Creative Commons licensed collaborative repository that provides the first publicly available research framework for people working to measure information control online censorship activities. In it, users can find the resources they need to perform their research more effectively and efficiently. It is based on a Git repository where collaborators can add, edit, remove, and review content. It's currently available under magma.lavafell.org, and there is also an Onion service. Guide structure currently suitable for all users and allows obtaining accurate information on internet censorship for a variety of people, such as research fellows, journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, network engineers, or technologists. Since the internet censorship techniques are constantly evolving, the MagmaGuide's open collaborative structure allows users to distribute, modify, contribute, and review content, ensuring that the guide stays as up-to-date as possible. The code framework, content, and implementation of the MagmaGuide is available for anyone to edit, review, or reuse. The MagmaGuide is an interactive collaborative resource that requires the help of users like you to ensure it stays up-to-date with all of the latest developments in information controls and internet censorship and network measurements world. If you think you can contribute, please do. Thank you very much for your attendance, and thank you for this lightning talk. Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone at Librem Planet 2020. This is my lightning talk about how to browse the internet more privately and securely. My name's Side Pocket. I'm one of the co-founders of DEFCON 201. We are the DEFCON hacker group in New Jersey, one of the many across the nation. I've been involved in a lot of hacker stuff over the many years. Now, normally I do this talking about all browsers, but because it's a lightning talk and also due to the nature of this con, I'm going to talk about GNU Icecat as we load it here in the terminal. For those of you who are not aware, GNU Icecat is a Libre fork of Firefox that was made back during a dispute between the open source community and the Debian project. It was originally called IceWeasel, now it's known as Icecat. It has a lot of privacy stuff built in automatically, such as spoofing referrers and WebGL and do not load in custom fonts, but we still need to fortify this, so I want you to go and when you load it to go in the about colon config and do accept, and then we're going to go to an amazing website resource called privacytools.io. I recommend everyone to check out the full website, but for now let's focus on the web browser section. So you see this search function, we're going to copy and paste that into the about config to find it. Now currently its value is selected as true. This is for the WebCCR, which can leak your data. This should be set to false. When you double click it, this will turn to false. Now, even though there's good security for Icecat, there's a lot of functions, and you should go through every single one of these functions for different tracking preventions and network data leaks and change all the settings to what's listed on privacytools.io. If you want to do a fast setting change, you could download the privacy settings add-on from Firefox add-on page. Speaking of Firefox add-ons, I'm also going to recommend a couple of add-ons that I believe, in addition to the ones already preloaded, that would be very useful. Normally, I'd recommend a thing called NoScript, which blocks JavaScript, but honestly, LibreJava in the default GNU Icecat is so particular, let's put it that way, about blocking JavaScript that you don't need to install it. I also recommend installing HTTPS everywhere, which will set all of your URLs to HTTPS. You block origin to block multiple ads and trackers. Auto cookie delete to remove all of your cookies when you close the browser window. Privacy badgers, which does further tracking and will actually learn and detail who's tracking you. Decentralize, which prevents code injections over time. Grease monkey, which has a bunch of useful privacy resources, canvas blocker, which I'm shocked didn't go off, make sure that no one's tracking the way you browse your web page, and then chameleon, which once you enable it, works as spoofing a user agent, which will make, as you can see here, anyone tracking you think you're running a different operating system in a browser than you actually are. There's also more advanced options such as enabling do not track, disabling referrers, among other options such as script injection, keyboard fingerprinting, spoofing your screen size, and also you can adjust the whitelist and blacklist. Finally, even though I highly recommend the Tor browser, built into GNU Icecat is the ability to automatically connect through Tor in a proxy. So as you can see on the left in our Ubuntu, we are already running the Tor browser, which runs the Tor node. If we do a check at .torproject.org, let's enter that in again, you will see that we can connect to the Tor network. This also means we can connect to Tor websites such as internetarchive.org. Tor allows you to also generate different user agents automatically and is very good at protecting your privacy through the Onion network. Now, going through Tor, as well as all the techniques I just listed here, will not make you completely track-proof. However, it will make things such as Google more difficult to track you over time. If you are interested in what our organization does, recommend going to defcon21.org. We meet third five every month at Subculture in Jersey City. We hope you have a really awesome Libre Planet. So enjoy the rest of the lightning talks, and I look forward to seeing you hopefully at a future DEFCON 201 meeting. Peace.
Hi, my name's Shivram, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Oregano, which is an IRCV3 server written in Go. So first I have to explain what IRCV3 is. IRC is very old, it's existed for about 30 years now, and for about 15 years now, there's IRCV3, which is an effort to specify extensions to the protocol based on open standards and this community is in a strong place. Most major IRC projects, servers, clients, and service frameworks are participants, and we're making a lot of progress on exciting improvements to the core protocol. So Oregono is an IRC server, and it's also a little more than an IRC server, which we'll get into. It's been around for about 8 years now, and it's actively maintained, and we're making a lot of progress. In particular, version 1.0, the first sort of really production-ready release, came out last year, and version 2.0 came out just last week. The maintainers are me and my colleague Daniel Oakes. So, what are the project's design goals? So there's three main things to highlight. One is that it should be very easy to set up and self-host. You can get up and running in 3 or 4 commands. The hardest part really is getting a valid TLS certificate, but even that is not very difficult anymore thanks to the great work done by Let's Encrypt. The second goal is to be a bleeding-edge IRCv3 reference implementation. We work very closely with the specifications process. We implement the ratified specs and also the draft ones, which contributes to the specification development effort. But the third goal is to integrate three pieces of software that have traditionally been separate in the IRC ecosystem: the IRC server, or the IRCD as it's called, the services framework, and the bouncer. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what those are. So what that means is, in one single portable statically linked binary, we provide user accounts and channel registrations. This is without the need for an external services framework like Inopa or Theme. And we also allow multiple clients to share a nickname. We have history storage and playback. And we allow always-on clients, that is, clients that remain present on the server and can retain messages even without the need for any actual client connections. And this is all without the need for clients to have long-running terminal-based clients or bouncers like ZNC. For example, I know people who have a VPS, the sole purpose of which is to run a ZNC, and we're trying to eliminate the need for that. There are privacy concerns with server-side history retention that have not been salient in traditional IRC setups, and we want to provide server administrators with the tools to mitigate those issues. In particular, the server administrator can set an expiration time for messages, so messages will be deleted after, say, 3 days or a week. We also provide the option to limit history playback to messages that the client could hypothetically have seen when they were sent, that is to say, messages sent after the client's account registration date. So what this means is a newcomer can't come in and poke around arbitrarily in past messages, but once they join the community, then they have access to all the messages that they could have seen from that point onwards. Because it's Go, it will run on many different kinds of computers. It will scale down to something as small as an ARM home router or a Raspberry Pi. It'll scale up to a big Intel server. It can be deployed for high availability using Kubernetes, and we support advanced privacy features like IP cloaking and onion addresses. And you can find us on GitHub or Freenode. Thank you very much for your time.
Hamidaki Yapi. Grant Shoshin Shangru Amatiapi. Bloketu Kunheha Lakota Summer Institute Ektawai. Pizpiza Wama Yaba Yeye Wamakashka Wanji Wumbalake. Hello, relatives. They call me Grant Shoshin Shangru. One of these past summers, I went to the Lakota Summer Institute.
It was a place where I started to learn the language, the indigenous language of the tribe I belong to, the Oglala Lakota. And this talk is just a tiny, tiny slice of the intersection of free software and First Nations, which is a huge topic, and I would love to develop a longer talk on it for some other time, but I only have 5 minutes. The last line there, Bispiza Wanwayawa Iyaye Wamakashkan Waji Wambalake, just says the prairie dog walked, went to school. I see one animal. And that's just about the level of the Lakota language that I have, that I am trying to teach to my daughter here in this picture. And that's a line from one of the books I have that's in Lakota to read to her. And there's a whole kind of issue with all of this stuff, which is, and the issue is that the person who wrote this children's book, one of the only children's books that exists in Lakota I can read to my daughter, was a person from England who studied the Lakota language as an academic, and he's a great person, and I'm glad that we have this book, but even the language that we're trying to reclaim for ourselves is being taught to us by academic people who studied it in college, and not by the people themselves necessarily. So that's kind of why free software is important. Free software gives people the power to take things into their own hands, and like I was able to type these words in one of the Lakota orthographies because I was able to use Emacs, which is one of the flagship pieces of free software. And so this is just kind of a brief talk about how I was able to use Emacs and free software in order to create an input mode so that I could type the Lakota language when there was no other way available for me to do that. So Emacs is great. I use this command here actually to set the size of the frame. I forgot to delete it. But there's a part of Emacs that comes with it called the Emacs input mode that lets you define different ways of using the keyboard to input things into the text editor. And there's another part of that called Quail. And Quail was a package written by a Japanese person, I think, you know, in order to enter Japanese text into Emacs. And so I found an article about how to use Quail to define package and Quail define rules in order to create a new input mode for Emacs that might not exist. If I press Control-U and then Control-Backslash, oh, I can't show you because Emacs is having a problem right now. But anyways, there's a whole menu of 190 some different language input modes you can use, you know, Chinese, Japanese, all kinds of different languages. And so I was able to use that to define a way that I could input these words into Emacs. So here it is. I just had to use this function quail define package. It takes a bunch of strings and documentation and then a bunch of things I don't know. But then it's actually really pretty simple. You just quail define rules. This basically says, this is what I'm going to type on the keyboard, and this is what I want Emacs to input into the buffer. So A followed by an apostrophe will input this accented vowel. Same for the other ones. And then just these consonants here. And then I provide the package, and I can type in Lakota. There's a whole other thing I could open up to talk about all of this, but I am out of time. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this talk.
Hello, everyone. I'm Özcan, Özcan Uls. Hello from Istanbul. Unfortunately, the in-person mode has cancelled, so we are streaming from Istanbul. My lightning talk is about free software and political movements in Turkey. In memory of Mustafa Akgül, who was the de facto leader of free software movement in Turkey. I want to start with history of free software in Turkey. Turkey met with internet first time in 12th of April 1993 in Ankara. And the free software movement in Turkey is starting with it. There was an email list in Bilkent University called linux@bilkent.edu.tr. And this is the first community of free software in Turkey. And they made a conference called Internet in Turkey Conference and Academic Bilişim, Academical Information Technologies Conferences in Turkey. First in 1995 and 1999. And there were pre-conference courses there. They teach GNU/Linux system administration. And so many people get involved in community by this way. And our first free software and GNU/Linux event was held on 2000. Because in 90s there was an oppression on events in Turkey, and in these days hanging banners on streets without permission would be punished by 2 years imprisonment, so it was very hard. But in 21st century in Turkey the winds of liberation began to blow. And in 2007, government announced Pardus project. It's a GNU/Linux distribution by governments. They develop a GNU/Linux distribution, and so many people, including me, was met for the first time with free software with this project. If we look at political topics. It started from 2011 with "Internetime dokunma" protests, "Don't touch my internet" protests. It was on the 15th of May 2011 in 30 cities of Turkey. And the story behind it, I will explain in short. The government announced an internet law draft. The government forced internet users to select one of four profiles: family pack, child pack, standard pack, and domestic pack. And it was totally a censorship over the internet, and you can't escape from it. And starting from the internet, so many NGOs sued this draft, and the BTK, the Regulation Office for Telecommunications in Turkey, sent a word list that contains 136 banned words to ISPs and wanted them not to assign domain names including these words. Some of the words are skirt, gay, hot, partner, picture, team, and 31. It's a slang for masturbation in Turkey, in Turkish, and so on. And after that, BTK sent a letter to hosting companies to shut down some sites they host, including Ekşi Sözlük. Ekşi Sözlük is one of the biggest websites in Turkey. During this controversy, so many NGOs summoned a protest on this date against the censorship and oppression policies of government, and we were there, actually. After these marches, government pulled back their draft, and it was the first sign that street movements have power to change something in country. After that, along the process, the street protest count increased in significant amount. Almost every day there was a march in Taksim. In 2013, Recep Tayyip Erdoğan said they will demolish Taksim Gezi Park and build a mall called Topçu Kışlası. But after that, individuals started to gather in Gezi Park, and quickly it turned into huge protests all over the Turkey. After Gezi, Free Sofi, hacktivism and hacktivists became non-spreading. Globally anonymous and locally redek supported Gezi Park by hacktivist acts, and hacker spaces are found in all over Turkey, from east to west, not only in big cities. By these updates, free software subculture gained power, and its spectrum was widened by every dimension. Requests for freedom by society in every kind of areas also raised software freedom struggle. Starting from now, we are more strong and more hopeful. We will win and defeat everything against our freedom. Thank you.